In part by Ratio Architects, dedicated to defining spaces and creating downtown places across the Midwest. On the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Imagine this. You and your spouse are 40-somethings. You're fit and you're in love. Among the interests you share, cooking. In fact, you're a food writer. Then, and this seems to come at you right out of the blue, you learn your husband has had a heart attack. There's been some damage to the heart. True story. It happened to Cecily Ross and her husband, Basil Ginnan. Their world was shaken. But hold on. As Cecily Ross says, this is a story with a happy ending. And as a writer, she wanted to tell it. So she wrote a book. Cecily Ross is the author of Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir with recipes. The book is the story of how she and her husband learned to adjust to life after his heart attack and heart bypass surgery. And food, it continues to be an important part of their lives. Cecily's memoir reflects that. Each chapter contains recipes like leek and smoked salmon frittata, pesto lasagna, and red chili salsa and tortilla soup. Cecily Ross is a senior editor and writer for Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail. Her work has also been featured in The New York Times. Her book, Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir with recipes, is published by McGraw-Hill. Cecily, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Celeste?
I'm fine, thanks. You say at the outset of this book, this is a story with a happy ending. And maybe here at the outset, we could go back to the beginning of this story with a happy ending. The two of you met when you were both working for a magazine, but for some time you were just friends. When and how did that change?
Well, I don't know. I'm a few years older than Basil, and we had a friendly relationship, and I never imagined that he would be attracted to me, and I don't think he thought I would be attracted to him, and he's shy, and I maybe lack self-confidence, so we kind of danced around each other for quite a few years.
And what was it about him that you found attractive?
Well, he's a very shy and decent and unassuming man, and he's also very good looking, and so we had a lot in common. We both worked in the media, we both, you know, loved movies and books and things, and so I just sort of had this secret crush on him. And then one night he invited me to his house for dinner, and we bonded over roast chicken.
And what was your courtship like following that?
Well, it was up and down a bit. Basil was dating someone else, and I didn't want to get involved with someone. We knew we were attracted to one another, and I didn't want to be involved with someone who was more or less attached to another person. So we broke up for a period of about 3 months, and I said, you know, when you've sorted your personal life out, then you can call me. And I thought I'd never see him again, and I thought that was the end of it. But about 3 months later, indeed, he did call. And 5 months after that, we got married.
Wow.
So we were quite impulsive. I have two grown daughters, and they were horrified.
Impulsive and yet not, though.
Yes, no. I mean, we lived along, you know, we weren't teenagers anymore, and we knew that this was what we wanted.
Yeah. Now, at the time of the heart attack, Basil was slim and fit, 44 years old. He didn't smoke, watched his weight. Did the heart attack come out of the blue?
It did, although, you know, it shouldn't have really surprised us, but you never expect the worst to happen. And, I mean, he had heart disease in his family, and his father, both his father and mother, had died at relatively young ages, and all his father's brothers died in their 40s. So it was in his genes, and he knew that, and we knew that. It's just that he took such good care of himself, you know, that it caught us completely by surprise.
Yeah. However, looking back, and, you know, hindsight is such a wonderful thing, looking back on it, he could put his finger on the day he had the heart attack.
Yes, he could. He knew. I mean, he was at the gym, and he was on the treadmill, and he started having terrible chest pains, and he thought he was going to die. And he stopped and laid down on a mat to get his breath, and when the severe pain started to subside, he got up, and rather than asking for help or going to the hospital, he got on his bike and rode. It's about a 10-minute bike ride to our house from the gym. And he rode home, and he came in the door and said, "I thought I was going to die, and all I could think of was that I wouldn't see you again." And I said, "You thought you were having a heart attack?" And he said, "Yes." And he looked so strong and robust standing there, and we both kind of laughed about it, said, "Oh, a heart attack, ha ha." And we didn't find out until 4 or 5 months later, when he actually had to go to the hospital to have emergency bypass surgery, that there had in fact been a heart attack, that the EKG showed that there had been damage to his heart.
Yeah. Well, as you say, the moral of the story is, if you think you're having a heart attack, maybe you are.
Yes, yes. That's right.
Were there other signs that there was something wrong at that point in time?
Yes. Looking back, he hadn't been feeling well for several months. He'd had a very bad bout of the flu around Christmas that he hadn't really bounced back from. And I don't know, but there are some people who have linked heart disease with viruses. But anyway, he just didn't bounce back, and he was tired, and he was he seemed depressed, and his energy levels were lower than usual. So we now realize that even before the chest pains started, that, you know, he wasn't himself. Something was wrong.
Yeah. So we went to the doctor, but his doctor thought it was something else, kind of, you know.
He had a little bit of arthritis in his hands, and the doctor had prescribed an anti-inflammatory to treat that. And anti-inflammatories can be hard on your stomach. So when he thought, and I thought, and the doctor thought, that he was experiencing a gastroesophageal thing that was related to the anti-inflammatory. So she prescribed an antacid for that. But he was then having really what felt like really severe heartburn. And although he'd never had stomach problems in his life before, but it was awful. We were hikers. We loved to hike, and we would go on these hikes on the weekends, and Basil couldn't make it up, you know, the smallest hill. He'd have to stop to catch his breath. And he finally went back for a follow-up visit after the antacid was prescribed and said, "This is not working. I think I have angina," and she immediately got him an appointment with a cardiologist.
Yeah.
Who sent him straight to the hospital from his
right home. Right. Are the two of you better now at paying attention to your bodies? And the other part of this, of course, would be you get scared at everything and anything.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, Basil is an anxious person anyway, and I was always trying to, you know, calm his fears, but now he really does have something to be afraid of. And his anxiety, that's been one of the biggest challenges, was coping with his anxiety over this. So, yes, he is more careful, but that's not always a good thing. He started having anxiety attacks about 9 months after the surgery, and he even ended up back in the hospital thinking he had another heart attack. And it was just anxiety, and so he stopped exercising at one point because he was scared to get his heart rate up. And that's not a good thing, you know. It took him until Christmas of this year, actually, which happened after the book was finished, in order to find. He finally went out and bought himself an exercise bike. And I said, "Why did it take you so long to do this?" And he said, "Well, I was scared to. I mean, he was scared to get his heart rate up."
It's very common, though, isn't it?
I think so. Yes. I mean, I think different people react differently. Some people are just in total denial about and. And they just go back to living exactly the way they did before. Other people have complete changes and start running marathons and you know, become vegan marathon runners. But I think Basil was somewhere in the middle. You know, he was already living a pretty healthy lifestyle, but he needed to refine that and learn how to relax and not react to stress in a sort of escalating kind of way.
Yeah. What did he learn about dealing with the anxiety?
Well, he did several things. One of the most important was he took a mindfulness meditation program. And so what he learned to do was to become more self-aware. I mean, his reactions to stress used to just escalate out of control. I mean, he'd start to, if he was in a stressful situation, he might get angry or afraid, and that would just build until, you know, his blood pressure would go up, all these things would happen. What he learned was to be aware of his reactions to these things and then to learn to calm himself down. And so it's an imperfect science, but he's much better at it. He's much more aware of, I mean, just the other day, he was having his whole family over for lunch, and as he was sort of preparing the food, he said to me, "You know, I get really uptight when my family is coming for lunch."
Join the club.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's able to then manage those feelings and realize that they are just feelings, and it is in your head, and to stay calm. I mean, he forgets sometimes. We all do, but that's been very good. And so he's learned to go away and calm down, and he's learned that exercise also makes him feel much, much better. So,
yeah. And on your part, did you have a problem with anxiety? Certainly you had some anxiety, my God.
Well, I did, yeah. But I tend to be an easier-going person than Basil, although I'm not as easygoing as I think I've discovered. And so I've learned a lot through watching him learn about himself, and I've learned to be more aware of how I'm behaving and how I'm feeling, so that I can take steps to. Because when I start to get overexcited or over anxious, it completely feeds his anxiety. You know, I mean, married couples are like a finely tuned machine, and our emotions are interconnected.
Yeah, that is so true, isn't it? This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer Cecily Ross. She is the author of a memoir, Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir with recipes. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What were the first days like for the two of you as Basil's in the hospital and waiting for surgery.
Well, he had about a 12-day. The first thing he had to wait for was the angiogram, which was the test, you know, that they put a camera up through your arteries just to see the extent of the blockages to his heart. And we were very hopeful that it would just be, you know, a minor blockage, and they'd be able to do an angioplasty, which is they put a balloon up and then put a stent in and send you home the next day. No, he waited, I think, four or five days for the angiogram, and the test showed that he had that three of the arteries to his heart were blocked. One was 90% blocked, the other two were 100% blocked. And he was in grave danger. It's amazing that he's very lucky to be alive. And so then he had to wait another four or five, 6 days, because hospitals in Canada have a triage system, so that, you know, the most serious case goes first, and for the actual surgery. And so that was a whole other little world that we kind of created for ourselves. And it was a sort of, so many people have gone through it. You know, it's such an old story, this heart surgery thing, including your own Bill Clinton. But when it happens to you, it's a major and life-changing event. And then the surgery, which is incredibly invasive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to open up your chest and stop your heart and lungs, and it's a routine operation for the surgeons. Luckily for the surgeons performing it, because they're such skilled technicians, and they do so many of them with an aging population. But when it happens to you, it's a big deal, and the recovery time is long and difficult.
Well, what were the toughest moments for you?
The toughest moment for me was the day of the surgery, when he was having his surgery, and his two sisters came to the hospital to wait with me, and they have a huge waiting room set up just for cardiac patients, and he was in surgery for about 7 hours, and so that was very difficult waiting, even though, you know, I went in thinking everything was going to be fine, nothing would go wrong. Generally after the operation, the surgeon comes out to talk to the family after the operation's over and to reassure them that everything's fine, and then you're taken down to see your spouse or father or whoever it may be, while they're still, before they've come out of the anesthetic. But the surgeon who performed Basil's surgery was called immediately into an emergency operation, so he didn't come to talk to us. So they kind of forgot about us. Mm. So another 2 hours went by, mm. and still no sign that he'd come out of his surgery. And when we finally asked, they sort of said, "Oh gosh," and took us to the ICU where he was. But I was convinced on that sort of long trek down the corridors to ICU that he had, that something terrible had happened, because it had been so long. So there was this rising panic and this certainty that the worst had happened. And then when I saw him, it was just huge, immense relief rolled over me.
Yeah. How did, you mentioned the triage system, how did the healthcare system perform for you? Were you happy with it?
Yes, once you get in the system, it's wonderful. The waits are not good. I mean, when you think that we spent 12 days in the hospital waiting for the surgery, and then 4 days after the hospital, they scoot you out when you're feeling like a newborn baby still. And so that's a poor use of hospital beds, really, to have someone. I mean, he couldn't leave and go home, because then he'd been admitted through emergency, and he would have gone to the bottom of the list if he'd gone home, which might have entailed another 2 months wait, which he couldn't do that.
Right.
So it's just there's this, and I'm not a healthcare professional, so I don't know, but it just seems to me a poor use of a shortage of beds. But once we were in the system, the care was phenomenal. I mean, the heart surgeons here are among the best in the world, and the nurses in ICU were in intensive care after the surgery for 48 hours. A nurse, they work 12-hour shifts, and 12 hours on, and another 12 hours, another nurse comes on, and all they do, I mean, one nurse is assigned to one patient, and they provide all the care. They sit there and watch the monitors and monitor everything. It was amazing. So I thought I was really impressed with the care.
Yeah. And then you didn't have to worry about the bill coming due either, did you?
No, we didn't have, no. It didn't cost us a penny. It's a wonderful thing. I don't know, to have to go through that and then to have to wonder how you're going to pay for it. I can't even imagine what it would cost.
Yeah.
So yes, this is we're very lucky to live in this country and have this kind of health care.
On the other hand, you did have to wait, you know, with his heart in such poor condition.
I did, yes we did, and that wasn't good. There are certainly moves afoot now to shorten those wait times because they're But it's a big, big issue here, the wait times. I mean, I myself just had to wait 6 months for a biopsy, and it was benign, luckily, but I thought, well, I could be dead by now.
So, wow.
Yeah, you don't have, and, you know, I mean, and yet, I mean, we, people who can pay for it can always go to the U.S. and have those procedures done, and
yeah.
It happens. So, in effect, I think we do have a two-tier healthcare system, just for that reason.
Life at home for you while you were waiting for Basil's surgery, what was it like?
Well, it was, you know, you're kind of a bit numb because the you're anticipating this operation. Your routine is completely shot. He had just started a new job. We had no idea what was going to happen. His employer was wonderful and said, just don't worry about it, and I mean, he hadn't even sort of finished his probationary period. He'd only been there a couple of months, and they were very good, but I think you just kind of go through the motions. I had my family and very good neighbors, and everyone was terrific, and but I thought, boy, this isn't what I thought was going to happen with us, you know?
Yeah. So much we take for granted, huh?
Yeah, that's right. It seems like a very ordinary story, but it happens to so many people, and I thought I was marrying this young health. I used to worry about, you know, the difference in our ages, and I stopped that, certainly.
Well. And at this point, you know, it also seems that you really get a full blast of your mortality.
Yes.
You know, it hits you so head on.
Yes. Yes, it's true. And so there are things that you think, I'd like to think that it's made us embrace life more fully. And for sure we have. I think one of the, it's funny, the little things you want to do. One of the things that Basil realized he wanted to do was learn to ride a horse.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a real city boy, and but he just has this kind of romantic love of horses. I mean, since the book has come out, we have now moved to the country. I mean, so we've become a bit sort of impulsive. He bought that horse. He learned to ride it. And we bought another horse. We live on a farm. I mean, we completely changed our lives. And I don't think that Basil ever would have done those things if this hadn't happened to him, if this heart hadn't. It made him, he tended to be a cautious person, and it has made him more willing to take risks.
Yeah. it seems, too, that that allows you also, that's got to have an impact on stress and anxiety, too. You know, you embrace life rather than shrinking back from it.
Well, that's right. I mean, which can be stressful. I mean, moving, risk-taking, new things, they bring on a stress of their own. And the only way to live stress-free is to, I guess, become a Buddhist monk and go and sit on a mountain somewhere and meditate. But you can't do that. So it becomes a balancing act, and you have to balance your need for peace and simplicity in your life with your need for challenge and adventure. And I haven't figured out that balance. It's an ongoing challenge. So,
So we
live in the country and worry about the horses. And
sounds pretty good.
It is, actually, especially this time of the year. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Was your marriage strained, do you think, from the whole experience, or strengthened, or both?
Well, I guess both. But, you know, marriages are constantly evolving things, and your marriage is never the same, really, from one day to the next. I mean, it changes. I mean, the way it is in the early days, that changes into something else. And this is a second marriage for me, and it's made me realize that that marriage is it's like work, really. It's like a job. I mean, you have to bring that to it. That sounds terribly unromantic, I know, but you have to have a commitment. I mean, you have to be able to say, well, you know, today maybe I'm not feeling so great about all of this, but that doesn't matter. That's just the way I'm feeling today. And you have to be forgiving. You have to forgive yourself for not being perfect. You have to certainly forgive the other person for being perfect, which when I was much younger, I wasn't, you know, I would dwell on the sort of things that I thought were not
the way
right,
you wanted them.
Yeah, and you can't do that. This is the person you got, and you have to. I mean, they're never going to be perfect, and I'm making it sound really really awful, but it's not. Basil is. The short answer is yes. It strengthened our marriage absolutely for sure. This was the for worse part, you know.
Yeah. Well, some days, and I think anybody who's been married would agree with you that, you know, some days you just show up.
Yeah.
You know, and you say I'm here, but I'm not in tip top shape today. You know, but this will pass.
And it passes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get through it.
Yeah.
So, go ahead. I think you wanted to say something else there.
Well, you know, I mean, Basil is a remarkable person. I mean, I'm so lucky to have someone who is. I think that the thing that he uses most of all to relieve his stress and to get through it all is humor, and we laugh so much together, and we do so much together, and so it's great. I mean, the big challenge for me has been to give myself a little bit of space, you know, because what I started doing was. Worrying. I became really, really worried about him all the time. I mean, if I thought he wasn't exercising enough, or I thought maybe, you know, he shouldn't have that second drink, or that he was working too hard, or whatever. I mean, I would just get myself into a stew about these things. So what was happening to him was happening to me, and I've had to, and I'm still learning, not to do that, to I can't change everything. You know, he has to do that, and I can only be there with him, but I have to be able to detach when it's important to do that.
Mm. So. Have you done something that would be equivalent to his learning to ride a horse?
I wrote a book.
That's right.
Gosh, you know, no, I have. Well, I'm riding now, too, after many, many, many years of not doing so, and I still am really ambivalent about it. It's a lot of work and a lot of, and I'm not as romantic about horses as Basil is, but that's been good. But no, I haven't actually. At one point, I thought I'd take up fly fishing, but I sort of tinkered with it. But
it takes a lot of patience.
Yeah, and I'm not that patient.
Yeah, I'm not either.
No. My father was a great fly fisherman, and I thought, oh, well, I'll just, you know, maybe it's in my genes, but no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the things that we've been talking about so far are so serious.
Mm-hmm.
And your book is a good read, and there's a lot of humor in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some wonderful recipes.
Yeah.
Let's talk about food.
Okay.
The two of you enjoy food very much. But
a lot.
Yeah. How has what you eat, how has what you cook changed?
It hasn't changed that much, you know. It's just a sort of, we've kind of, the emphasis has changed rather than the substance. And so we try to eat less meat than we did, for sure we do. We eat more fish. We're way more aware of the foods that are really good, heart healthy foods. So we try to eat a lot more of those, and we try to limit our fat intake. And believe me, we're not perfect. And we try to move around more. You know, we try to. Move around more, eat more of the good things and fewer of the bad things.
Hmm.
It's really funny because if we have people in, you know, the expectation is that we're going to serve them, you know, low-fat, heart-healthy food. But the funny thing is that when we have people in, it's one time when we can celebrate, and so we feel we just kind of let the rules drop a bit. So, you know, in the summer, we'll barbecue steak when we have guests over, and they say, well, really, you're eating steak? And we said, well, we never eat steak, so this is special for us.
Yeah. Tell us about pesto lasagna.
Oh, that's a really good recipe.
And it looks pretty healthy.
Yeah, it is, because it calls for cheese, but I use a low-fat mozzarella and a low-fat ricotta, and it's meatless, but it loses nothing in the translation. It's simple to make. You can make it ahead of time and freeze it. I serve it all the time. And it's, you know, the pesto, you can either make your own pesto and your own tomato sauce, or you can buy bottled versions of each. And it's really great with a salad. It's the perfect, well, it's the perfect lunch or dinner.
Yeah. It's made with tomato sauce and the cheese you mentioned, of course, low fat,
mm-hmm.
and fresh lasagna noodles. And I had a question here. Can I use those no-boil lasagna noodles?
Yeah, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I never have used them. But I think you can, because the point. But you might increase your liquid a bit.
Okay.
You'd have to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they probably work pretty much the same way as the fresh lasagna noodles. We can here buy them in packages, great sheets of lasagna noodles, and they're in the fresh pasta section of the supermarket, and so the liquid in the recipe cooks them as well.
Mm.
But I think the no bake would work okay. Fine.
The no boil. We don't have we don't have fresh lasagna noodles. In our pasta section. Nope.
Can you get like fresh ravioli?
Yeah, we can. Well, let's share this recipe with our listeners. It's tomato. It's so simple. The tomato sauce is a couple of tablespoons of olive oil, a small onion chopped, two cloves, garlic minced, a 28-ounce can of plum tomatoes, a tablespoon of tomato paste. That's the tomato sauce. And then that's the sauce. And then you have the package of lasagna noodles, two cups of the low-fat mozzarella, two cups of light ricotta, 1 1/4 cups of the pesto, and a half cup of grated Parmesan cheese, and you just layer it up like lasagna.
Yep.
And bake it in the oven, and presto.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
I find that we go back to a lot of these recipes over and over again. There's a muffin recipe that is really great in the book too, and
it's whole grains and blueberries.
Yeah,
that sounds good.
You know, it has flax and wheat bran and oat bran and all of those things, but and bananas, blueberries, or raspberries if you want, and that's a good one.
Yeah. Did you work with a dietitian, or the two of you, with your knowledge of food and your enjoyment of cooking, did that just sort of kick in? Were you naturals at making over favorites?
Yeah. I mean, no, we didn't work with a dietitian, and this is not meant to be a book that's... there are lots of books out there that'll give you, all the various parts and... But this is just, I just wanted to share some of the things that we like to eat that we think will help you, help people in the same position as we are.
And it's also a reminder that life is still good.
Yeah, it is. And you have to be forgiving, and food can still taste good. I find that some of the heart healthy books are a bit austere, and I can't believe that. I think you can't eat a fat free diet for very long without becoming depressed. And certainly, women I've heard shouldn't they need saturated fats in order to, especially as they get older. So, and cholesterol, you have to remember, is something the body produces naturally. And the school is out on cholesterol. It's surprising how little they really know about diet and heart disease.
Hmm. Cecily Ross is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left in this portion of the program. So if you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, if you've got a question or comment, you can give us a call, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Cecily Ross, the author of Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir with recipes. Well, my husband and I have been paying a lot more attention recently to labels, and we've made some happy discoveries that some things that are labeled good for you and low fat actually taste good. What have been a couple of your favorite discoveries for trimming back on the bad stuff while not sacrificing taste?
One of our favorite things is, and we use it as a substitute for butter, or we use it in salads. It's avocados. I should write another book called The Joys of Avocados. we have two dogs, and they love avocados so much that so we all have to fight over them. But just a simple thing like an avocado, they're quite high in fat, but it's a good fat, and they're just, it's wonderful just smeared on sandwiches or made into guacamole. There's an excellent guacamole recipe in the book, they're wonderful in sandwiches because we try not to eat, we don't butter things, mm-hmm. or we try not to use mayonnaise as much. So that's one thing. Seasonings like It probably took a long time to sort of wind its way to Canada, but the chipotle sauces and flavorings, the smokiness of them, adds so much to foods and sauces and soups. And so we're in favor of, you know, of strong flavors, and we use a lot of chili pastes as well, Indian and Thai chili pastes. I find that a lot of ethnic cooking is really so long on flavor and long on also vegetables and noodles and grains and low on meat and fat. So that's we lean towards those kinds of things.
Yeah, and there are so many things that you can add. You mentioned chipotles, the chilies, also vinegars and citrus, mustards, citrus. All just are, they add so much spark.
That's right, and you can experiment with them. You know, you can really have fun with those kinds of things. And, I mean, it's so easy to fall into the, I call it the chop method of eating, which is, you know, is like a chop of starch, a vegetable. And we're trying to rearrange that. We've come up with a lot more vegetarian. The chickpeas are a great savior. There's an excellent recipe for chickpeas and spinach in the book too, which is really good.
How do you make that?
Gosh, I wish I had the book in front of me, but it calls for chickpeas and spinach and smoked paprika, if you can get it, although you don't need to use that. And you're basically sautéing the chickpeas in cumin and olive oil, and then wilting the spinach into it, and adding a little smoked paprika, and it's really good.
That's
the Spanish Mediterranean.
Yeah, it reminds me of a recipe I saw somebody make on television the other day where they did roughly that, and then they made it. Then it's to be served at room temperature, so you then make up a little yogurt dressing, which is...
yes, that would be a good addition.
Plain yogurt, a tiny bit of honey, a little bit of orange juice and orange zest.
You'll have to send me that.
Well, that's roughly it.
Yeah.
You know, but I'll look it up.
Okay. You know, a lot
and
of
I'll
these
send
things
it to you.
Are wonderful, too, if you make extra to, I mean, because lunches are a challenge. You know, sort of the restaurant meals are a challenge because you tend not to know what you're eating. And so we make, you know, larger quantities of pasta or grain-based things that we're having. Even if we serve the spinach and chickpea dish as a side dish with fish, we make extra, and it's excellent for lunch the next day.
Yeah. Also, I'm looking forward to trying your suggestion, maybe not even with salmon, but with other fish, lentils and fish together.
Yes, we lentils are you know, instead of potatoes or rice, we'll often have lentils now.
Yeah.
And they're really high in fiber, really, really good for you. So, you get the little French Dupuis lentils. They're much
better. The tiny ones, they're much more tender. And I bet we could cook up a salad like the chickpea thing we were just talking about with lentils. Just use lentils instead of the chickpeas.
Oh, I'm sure you could, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Because these are high protein, high fiber foods, and they're a great substitute for meat in your diet.
Yeah.
Instead of meat.
I wish you were next door. I'd be right over. We could have lunch.
Yes, we could.
Yeah. Well, there we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
Cecily, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thanks a lot, Celeste.
Cecily Ross has been our guest in this portion of the program. She is the author of Love in the Time of Cholesterol, a memoir with recipes. The publisher is McGraw-Hill. And that interview conducted on June 7th of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, 76 degrees in Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Todd Gleason is standing by now with a look at what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Todd?
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures in the corn and the bean pits off today, anywhere between 3 and 4 cents in the corn. Beans were off 7 to 9 for the day, but in the wheat pit, a little bit of a gainer. In Chicago, futures finished like this. July contract, 388. Settlement price at 386.5 and a low at 381. At 2.25 higher, at 388, of course, the high price there. September futures, 408, the high, the low at $4 even. Settlement price at 404.75. They were up 2.75. And December's, 427, the high, the low at 418.5. They settled at $4.23, up 2 for the day. The March contract, 441.5, the high, the low at 35. Settlement price at 38.75. And they finished a quarter higher. May futures, 449, the high. Low at 444, settlement price at 447.5, down a half for the day. July wheat in Kansas City, 7 cents higher, 512 the high, the low at 504, settlement price at 510, they were up 7. And July spring wheat from Minneapolis, 525 high, low at 510, settlement price at 520. They're leading the charge higher as dry conditions continue across the Great Plains states, up a dime there. Corn futures now, July contract at 3.75 lower, 243 the high, the low at 238.25. Settlement price in Chicago for the July corn, 239.5, down 3.75. September futures, 253.5, the high, the low at 48. Settlement price at 249.5, down 4 cents. And December's, 268.25, the high, the low at 263. Settlement price at 264.5. They were down 4. The March futures, 279.25, the high, the low at 275. Settlement price at 276.25. Off 3.5 cents. May futures, 286.5 high, low at 283. Settlement price at 284.75, down 3. And July contract in the corn pit down 2.75. 295 the high, the low at 291.75. Settlement price at 293, down 2.75. September futures off 3 cents at 298. Why, you say? Because of the weather, of course. That's been what's been driving the marketplace up most of the time this spring, and it looks like there'll be some awfully good rainfall sometime late next week, that being factored into the market today. July oats, 218 the high, the low at 213. Settlement price at 217, up 2.5 cents. September unchanged today, $1.95 the settlement price there. July soybeans, $6.50 the high, the low at 592. Settlement price at 594.5, down 7. August contract off 8 cents, $6.50 the settlement price there as well. Settlement price at 607, the low at 597. Once again, the August beans settled at $6.50. They were off 8 for the day. September futures, 614.5 the high, the low at 605, settlement price at 607, down 8.75. And November beans down 8.25, 621 the settlement price, the high price at 628.5, the low at 617. January futures, 638 the high, the low at 628.5, settlement price at 630.5, off 8 cents, and the March contract at